the UCR Podcast.
This is a doubleheader for fans of the Allman Brothers Band. Today, we've got Warren Haynes and Derek Trucks joining us for separate conversations to talk about things that they have going on. Warren, let's talk about Warren first. Warren checks in to discuss the Whisper Sessions, a great digital collection set to land September 12th, featuring a number of acoustically based performances of songs from his latest album, Million Voices Whisper, which came out in 2024. Warren, one of the early guests on the podcast, he joined us last year to talk about that album, and listening to this new EP brought me back to listening to that record, and I feel the same way about it now that I did back then. It is just a stunning piece of work. The Whisper Sessions will be familiar to some fellow fans that saw the video performances that Warren put out online to showcase certain songs from Million Voices Whisper. They really do put the music in a different light, so I'm happy we have the opportunity to get these special renditions in an audio format as a proper release. In addition to the material from Million Voices Whisper, there's also a couple of cool cover songs, and Warren and Derek, who collaborated on several tunes for the original album, are together here as well to play some of those songs. We cover a lot in the conversation here today, and you can find all of the information you might need about the Whisper Sessions at warrenhaynes.net. I love talking to Warren, and the same thing is true when it comes to getting a chance to converse with Derek Trucks. We spoke most recently back in 2022, and during that conversation with Derek and also Susan Tedeschi, we had the chance to briefly touch on the very cool tribute that they did with the late Leon Russell back in 2015, honoring the 1970 Mad Dogs and Englishmen tour with Joe Cocker that has become legendary. Now, 10 years later, that tribute performance, which was recorded at the Lockin' Festival in the Virginia area, featuring some alumni from the original Mad Dogs tour, plus special guests like Dave Mason, Warren, Chris Robinson, and others, is being released officially for the first time on September 12th on streaming, CD, and vinyl. The story of how this tribute came together was thankfully chronicled in a documentary called Learning to Live Together, The Return of Mad Dogs and Englishmen, that Derek and Susan actually did a special screening of earlier this summer. But that documentary is not an easy thing to locate on regular streaming platforms, so I'm glad that they are releasing this tribute and doing some fresh interviews to share the story of what ended up being an epic night for fans of Joe Cocker and Leon Russell. And now that Leon and some other folks are gone or have stopped performing, it's pretty special to have this upcoming official release of their Lockin performance. The interview with Derek is a shorter one, so as an added bonus, I'm going to include what we'll call a bootleg cut of my 2022 conversation with Derek and Susan as well. And between the two, as you will hear, we dug through a lot of different topics. There were some audio imperfections with that recording of the 2022 interview, as you'll hear, but nothing that will take away from your ability to enjoy the conversation. Mad Dogs and Englishmen Revisited Live at Lockin' with Leon Russell is the name of the new live album from Tedeschi Trucks Band, and as I mentioned, that will be out on September 12th. You can pre-order it in a variety of formats at their official website, TedeschiTrucksBand.com, and to zoom out for a moment, of course, Warren Haynes and Government Mule have tour dates coming up, and Tedeschi Trucks Band is out on the road as we speak. The cool thing is that both bands will also share the stage for some shows together as well, and those will certainly be some special nights. If this is your first time hearing the UCR podcast, make sure to follow us so you will get future episodes as they are released. Let's dig into today's conversations, starting with Warren Haynes. Enjoy it. There you are, the real Warren Haynes.
How are you?
I'm good, man. It's real good. I will tell you, man, I am super happy that with the Whisper Sessions that you're putting these intimate performances out. Like, as you know, we are in this strange world as people and artists where, particularly for you on the artistic side, it seems like the demand is there more than ever for you to create a lot of different, what I'll call, content related to each project. And that's what you do. Like, so I'm assuming that in some form, that's kind of where this started. Where did this start to kind of feel like something more than that for you?
Well, you know, it started out as filming, as you say, content. It was, we were filming promotional videos of stripped down versions of the songs from A Million Voices Whisper. We chose a few different locations, and most of them were just like setting up in a house somewhere with a small film crew and a small audio team. We did a handful of them at Power Station, which is where the Million Voices Whisper was recorded. But, you know, listening back as we accumulated more and more, it just seemed like these stripped down versions kind of offered some insight into where the songs came from before they were fleshed out and before they were turned into full band extravaganzas. And you use the word intimate. It is a very intimate setting. It's kind of like when I do solo performances, which people that have never seen my solo performances don't really know what to expect. There's not a lot of virtuoso guitar playing. It's just me accompanying myself for the most part and playing the song. So the feature is on my voice and the songs themselves. And with the exception of the three songs I did with Derek, that's kind of what this is.
Yeah, I think it's kind of fun too. Like the Derek stuff is what I was thinking of in particular. As you know, like sometimes when you have somebody, whether it's Derek or whoever, coming in the studio to like play with you on a record, like unless they show up with you at a show somewhere to come out on stage and play the songs with you, it's like us as fans, we don't necessarily have the chance to see you guys going through the songs. So even just from a historic perspective, documentation, like it's kind of fun to just have video of you and Derek, you know, doing those songs in that way.
Yeah. And they were very impromptu, very low pressure. We didn't do anything more than once or twice, you know?
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, I talked to Derek yesterday separately just about Tedeschi Trucks stuff, but like I said this to Derek and it applies to you as well. Like, obviously you are a music fan at the core, like we all are. And you do a version of Tammy Wynette's Till I Can Make It On My Own from her 1976 album of the same name. Like, how did you first kind of come to that song and perhaps Tammy's music in general?
I've always loved that song. I can't remember the first time I heard it. It just goes way back. And of course, years went by when I didn't hear it and didn't think about it. And then I heard it in passing somewhere probably 15 or 20 years ago and just reminded myself what a great song it was. Starting about 5 years ago, I started thinking that I wanted to maybe cover it at some point. But it had only been in my head. I'd never sung it. And so when I got to the Power Station that day, I wanted to capture the first time I ever sang that song, which is what that performance is. And actually the only time, because I haven't done any solo performances since then, which would give me the opportunity to do it live. So that version is the only time I ever sang that song. So, there's a vulnerability in there, which is inherent in the song as well, obviously, and an emotional connection to it. Anytime you sing something for the first time, there's an emotional connection, you know?
Yeah, for sure. And you've got like threads of Nashville throughout your overall career, but like as far as country music, like that's always been such a huge rabbit hole as far as potential musical discovery, like the artists, the songs themselves, and also the songwriters. Since in Nashville, like, as you know, there's been that long history of the songwriters being behind the curtain of some really big hit records. And for you as a music fan, like, and I see this with the songs that you cover in your shows across the years, like, it's just a really fascinating onion to peel, really, regardless of what the genre of music is, but keeping it looking at country music, like country music has always been a really fascinating onion to like kind of examine.
Yeah. You mentioned the behind the curtain songwriters. You know, I've always gravitated toward the artists that wrote their own songs, but there are some fantastic writers that have existed in Nashville the past decade after decade that, when great artists cover songs by some of these great writers, it kind of raises the bar for what's going on at the time and changes the trajectory of the music, which is wonderful. You know, I mean, I've been fascinated with the whole singer-songwriter thing since I was probably 14 or 15. And it's interesting to study because singer-songwriters are a unique breed. You know, a lot of them kind of hide from the spotlight and, you know, kind of vacillate back and forth with whether or not they would want to be an artist. But some of the best songs to come out of that town are written by people that, you know, the mainstream world doesn't know anything about.
Yeah, for sure. And then one of the other songs on this Whisper Sessions, you play through a version of Melissa, like just generally, like I think it's really interesting. Like as I was looking back at like Tedeschi Trucks band set lists in recent times, like they'll pull out something like Stand Back. And I think that like you and Derek, to use two examples, I think you're always very thoughtful about the material you choose to kind of play from the band. So what kind of, I guess, how do you kind of approach, you know, picking the stuff that you pick to play? And in this case, like, how did you end up kind of pulling out Melissa for this?
Well, in the case of these sessions, Derek and I were holed up in a little house with a film crew and a little audio crew to do these changes and Real, Real Love. And when we were finished, I think he suggested maybe we should just play a cover or something just to have something extra. And one of us brought up Melissa, and we thought, well, yeah, let's do one take of it. And if it's good, we'll use it. And if it's not, we won't. And so we did that one take of Melissa, and we didn't talk about it. We played it enough times to where we didn't have to think about what was going to happen. We didn't even think about the solos or anything. You know, at the end of the song, he's playing a solo. He kind of looks at me. I take over and start playing a solo. It's, you know, that's something we've done hundreds of times before. And it turned out pretty cool. So it's like, well, yeah, we should include it. It's got an intimate vibe about it that captures the moment of us doing, you know, one of my all-time favorite Greg Allman songs for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? Listening to this, the Whisper Sessions brought me back just generally to the Million Voices Whisper album. And you mentioned these changes, and I just kind of keep, I continue to be fascinated by that song because there's an interesting economy to it because it's past the 6 minute mark, but it doesn't feel that way. You just kind of get lost in that song. And I wonder how that kind of felt for you when you were doing it. Does it kind of take you away in the same way? Like, what did it generate for you?
Yeah. It is one of those songs that doesn't feel monotonous when you play it for a longer period of time. And it's a very simplistic sort of chord arrangement, but it has a unique vibe about it. I think the thing that struck me the most was when we got into the studio to record it and work it up with the band, we had not talked about doing anything at the end where we jam and trade back and forth and go into that new chord progression. That wasn't part of the way we wrote the song. That just came up right as we were about to roll tape. Well, maybe we should go into a jam at the end. I mean, we're here. People want to hear that. We want to do it. We should just see what happens. And what happened resulted in the ending of that song kind of taking on its own life. And I really love the way that turned out. And again, it was very impromptu. And we love working that way. You know, I mean, all the music we love, or a lot of the music we love, came together that way, and we're just kind of caught up in continuing that philosophy, you know?
Yeah. There's an emotional tone to it that I think is identifiable. You just feel like you're listening to it and, you know, the person is going through it. So I think that for everybody that's human, that goes through things, you know, it's like when you're in a place where you feel a certain way, you hear that song and it kind of like, it's a certain kind of balm. And I would have to think that it's interesting for you, for where you started out as a songwriter. It probably feels to you like you've grown and progressed both as a singer and as a writer, to be able to kind of communicate and share those kind of emotions in a song the way you do in a song like that.
Yeah. And also when the COVID lockdown forced us all into seclusion, I and a million other songwriters found themselves writing more material than we'd written in a really long time. But more importantly, the focus and the subject matters and the perspective of what I was writing about had changed and felt like it was more universal in a way, because songwriting is such a personal thing. You know, you're bearing your soul and you're revealing your feelings. But during that time, that's the only time in my life that I can remember the whole world going through the exact same thing. And that bonded us all as human beings in a certain way and made me think about what we share as humans and kind of taking the next step towards getting out of your own way and making life better for yourself and for the people that you care about and focusing on the shit that's really important and not so much on the petty stuff. So all of a sudden the subject matters that I was writing about from that point forward shifted and became a little less me and a little more like human condition. And it was a breath of fresh air for me, because as songwriters, we're always looking for change. And this change kind of forced me to be a little more positive in my own outlook.
Yeah, that makes sense. Like, I think that's going to be interesting for you. Like, obviously the pandemic, that's a big moment that triggered a lot of things for a lot of people. But it's just like, that's not the first mile marker that you've had along the way that's opened something up. And it's like, it's very powerful when you have something, whatever it is, that just opens up and changes your process. And because just in the most basic fashion, like to open yourself up the way that you do with a song like that, and then decide that you want to share it with people, that's a big step for any songwriter, no matter what's going on.
Yeah, because, you know, a lot of my songs, and I'm sure every songwriter is the same way, a lot of the most personal ones, you're kind of reluctant to share. And sometimes you wonder if they should remain personal. And, you know, there's been songs through the years where it took a certain person to pull it out of me or a certain situation to pull it out of me where I felt like, yeah, I can share this, you know. And whenever that happens, it helps change course in a good way, because you know, we thrive on that change. That's, we're constantly looking for catalyst, you know?
Yeah. Well, we, as you know, lost Ozzy Osbourne earlier this summer, and I know you played Hand of Doom recently with the Mule, but you've done a lot of Sabbath music over the years, including that great Halloween show back in 2018 in Atlanta, where you guys play through all of Paranoid and some other stuff. And as someone like yourself, who's been a writer and a player for so long, like, what do you appreciate about the music of Black Sabbath? Because it is so unique.
Well, the uniqueness is a big part of it. You know, I, like so many other young rock fans and aspiring guitar players, discovered that music when I was really young. And it was so dark and heavy and different. It changed the mood. Like, it was, at that time, it was the first music that I had experienced that changed the vibe of the room, and everybody in the room listening to it. And it was a real vulnerable time for me as a listener, a real important time at that age when you're soaking up everything, and all that music's going to stay with you for the rest of your life. You know, a lot of that stuff I realized I hadn't heard for decades. And when we went back and revisited a lot of it, it was so cool to hear, you know, even the way the record sounded, like the way Paranoid was recorded. We all think of it as being this big, heavy thing, but the recording is like the drums sound kind of jazzy, and they don't sound like bombastic. It's, you know, that music was deceptive in the way that when it was being made, nothing like that had ever happened before. But when people started trying to copy it, they kind of missed the point a little bit, you know? And some of those tunes, like Hand of Doom, with all the different sections, you know, all these different musical sections, when we were figuring out an arrangement for it and rehearsing it, I kept thinking, wow, it's like three different songs mixed into one song. And War Pigs is kind of like that too. You know, a lot of those tunes, I love that era for that too, because people were not scared to have a lot of sections in a song and have, you know, a song in the middle of another song. And so when that actually carries over to when we did Peace Like a River with Government Mule, which was mostly written during the pandemic, a lot of that occurs in that album where, you know, there's songs that have six or seven moving parts as opposed to the normal rule of two or three, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, man. I, you know, obviously, like, this is all the stuff that, like, shapes you as a player. Like, it's just like you sitting there with the proverbial record player back in the day, pulling the needle back over and over as you're learning to play stuff. But that's, like, super interesting to hear how the experience of doing that Sabbath thing can feed back into, like, something down the line that you're doing, you know, with the Mule as a result of having, you know, revisited those songs with the Mule. And it's like, I always kind of have wondered that about, like, those Halloween shows that you've done, like, what that kind of brings back into your overall process, because you guys do tackle so many interesting things. Like, there's the stuff that makes a lot of sense. There's the Grateful Dead. There's the Neil Young sets that you've done. But then it's like, there's the stuff like the Black Sabbath set, or, you know, doing, like, you know, the AC/DC set with Miles Kennedy. Like, you guys have tackled some really interesting things.
Every time we do that, it influences in varying degrees what's going to happen in the future. You know, some that stuff has a way of coming back, even if it's just through osmosis, and even if it's just subtle, it comes back into the picture further down the line. And I've noticed that every time we make a record, you know, it's somewhat influenced by those one-off excursions like that, you know, and the ones you mentioned, like doing Neil Young, and we did a like 90 minutes of Hendrix one time, and
yeah,
and it was a blast. And so, you know, 2 years later, it's going to creep back into the picture. And when we're writing or just on stage jamming, you know, and I love that because we choose all these influences from all across the board, and they all reappear at some point in a cool way.
Yeah, and it's cool too because, like, you know, I know that, like, you know, you mentioned, like, going back to the actual Paranoid record. I think that's, like, instructive to kind of go back and remind yourself of how certain things were done, because it's just like you get so used to recording things in a certain way that, like, it's important to kind of remember, here's how some of these other bands did it, because there were some really important ways that they did things that we sometimes can take for granted now.
Yeah. And a lot of it was due to budget constraints or gear restraints. You know, they were just making the best out of what they had at the time, and in some ways making it up as they went along. You know, a lot of our favorite records were made by musicians that were really young at that time and still discovering the studio environment, you know, and depending on people that were more technically savvy to help guide them through the situations, but just a lot of experimenting and creating music that nobody knew at that moment was going to be timeless, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure, man. Well, among the many tour dates that you have coming up, you're going to be doing some tour dates where you're going to be sharing the stage with Derek and Susan. And I love how they've talked. I talked a little bit about this with Derek yesterday about what they're doing with their band was inspired by the Mad Dogs and Englishmen tour. And you do yourself, as we've been talking about, so many different things. Like, what do you take inspirationally being around something like the Tedeschi Trucks band? Like, I was telling Derek this. I remember talking to the two of them when they first took that Mammoth band out on the road for the first time at a time where it was potentially going to be a money losing endeavor at the very least. Or at the very least, I should say it was going to be a big swing to take, but they've pulled it off, which is cool to see. And so, you know, knowing for instance that, you know, you participated with them in that Mad Dogs tribute, like you certainly grew up in the time that you would have had the chance to see that concert film. And at a time when you see a concert film like that and some other films that came out in those early years, like it really was kind of unbelievable to see the chaos of what that band was at the time and some of the other things that were happening musically at that time, which would give you a definite appreciation for what Derek and Susan are now doing with that band, because it's a big swing to take in any era.
Yeah, no question about it. I was young when the original Mad Dogs and the Englishmen came out, but my oldest brother had the record, and we listened to it a lot in my house. But I was old enough to understand that it was a very unorthodox concept and could have been a total failure, could have been a total flop. The challenges were immense. But it's those kind of ventures that are like sink or swim, you know. Those kind of ventures have proven to be some of the most historical and timeless efforts in musical history. I didn't know a lot about the chaotic aspect of it at the time period, but they did a great job of capturing how massive that sound was, and something that you could only get from a band that large, you know. And that's one of the things that Tedeschi Trucks Band has managed to do, is utilize the power of a large ensemble like that. I used to talk about it in the Allman Brothers, in interviews, and the Allman Brothers was a much smaller band than Tedeschi Trucks. But the beauty of a large band, when you have two drummers, or in our case, two drummers and a percussionist, two guitars, bass, keyboard, it can be anywhere from a 7-piece band to a 2-piece band at any given moment, because everyone doesn't have to play all the time. And so there's something beautiful about when members drop out and it becomes a smaller sound. And then the contrast of that with the large ensemble, it just gives you so many dynamic options, and to go from a whisper to a scream and you know, a matter of a few bars is extremely effective. And I love the fact that they had this commitment to make that happen. I remember when Derek and I were talking about it on the bus with the Allman Brothers, one day he was telling me about this idea of having a band influenced by Mad Dogs and the Englishmen and Delaney and Bonnie and Friends. And that was the two examples that he kind of gave me, and about it being a really big band. And I remember thinking, wow, that's wonderful. But at the same time thinking, That's a lot to take on, you know. But when you have a vision that you're willing to commit to, you just got to see it through and plow ahead and make it happen. And that's what they've done.
Yeah. An Allman Brothers thing, something that I came across that was interesting. I think that maybe Nugs put it out recently or whatever the case was, but as they've been kind of like going back to those Allman shows, you guys in 2009 played a couple nights at the Greek, where the first night Tom Petty and some of the other, you know, Heartbreakers came out and jammed, but in the encore, Bruce Willis comes out to play Southbound with you guys. What was the connection with Bruce between Bruce and the Allmans? Like, how did you guys know him, or how did he guys know you? How did he know you guys?
Well, Bruce and I became really good friends. We were kind of neighbors for a while, and our kids went to school together. Bruce used to come to my son's birthday parties, and there would be pretty big parties, and some of our friends would be like, "Who's the guy that looks like Bruce Willis?" And it's like, "Oh, that's Bruce Willis. His daughter and my son go to school together." But long before that, Bruce sat in with Government Mule when we first started. We played a club in Philadelphia called the TLA, the Theater of Living Arts. And I got a call from someone saying, "Hey, you know, Bruce Willis is coming to your show and he plays harmonica. You should get him up to sit in." And I knew that he and John Popper had played together. And so I called Popper and said, "What do you think?" And he said, "Yeah, he's good. He's very respectful. He's a real musician. You should ask him to sit in." And so I did. And that was the beginning of our relationship. Then through the years, you know, it happened again. And he sat in with the Allman Brothers at the Beacon. He used to, when he was living in New York, he used to come to a lot of Beacon shows and just hang out, and was always very downplaying his presence, you know. And eventually, as I mentioned, we became good friends and hung out a lot. And, you know, harmonica was a real passion for him. You know, he took it very seriously.
I think we can all identify with that. Like, you know, people that do something, in this case, like him being an actor, that just like literally like he just wants to go and do something else and, you know, be a guy with the band sometimes. Like whatever it is you want to do that's your kind of escape, like that's kind of cool.
Yeah. And like you say, I think we all have those hidden passions and other sides to us that some people may not. No, there are a lot of actors and actresses that are singers and musicians, and some take it more seriously than others.
Yeah, for sure. I know that you mentioned the Mule, and it's like you and I, like somewhere around the 20th or 25th, you know, talked pretty extensively just about the beginnings of the band and all that kind of stuff. But it sounds like from what I've heard, like, is there some sort of expanded edition of the first record that's taking shape?
Yeah, there is a remastered version of the first album that's going to contain an entire CD of outtakes, mostly from the first record, but a few from the second and third records, all stuff with Alan Woody that when we comb through the archives, there's some fantastic stuff that never got released, mostly alternate versions of other songs. And there's enough of it where it completely fills up an entire disc. And I'm really excited to get that stuff out for the 30th anniversary.
That's cool. You know, final couple things. One, I know it sounds like there's another Mule record that's somewhere in the distance, and I've heard you describe it as like a rock and roll record. Like, what's the deal with that?
You know, it's still in the thinking stages at this point. Nice. You know, I've been kind of focusing on Million Voices Whisper and touring with that band. And now that's kind of coming to an end and Mule's coming back in to the focus. So now we're going to see what the next steps are and stuff. But I'm excited to make a record, a Mule record with Kevin Scott, which we haven't done yet. And he's been such an inspiration that, you know, I don't want to kind of even predict where it's going to go because the sky is the limit.
Yeah. Well, if we go back, you know, it's funny asking you about the Bruce Willis stuff because it's almost like the 6 degrees of Warren Haynes. And so I love if we look all the way back to like when your solo debut came out on Megaforce, Johnny Z was such an interesting character. How had you gotten to know Johnny? And then how does Chuck Lavelle end up coming into the picture in a producer capacity for that record?
Well, start with Johnny Z and Megaforce. I was shopping a deal for that record, and at that point had not even really made up my mind what kind of record it was going to be. I knew it was going to be a rock record, but it could have taken a more soul-infused approach than it did. You know, there were a lot of songs that I had already written back then that, like Soulshine was on the large list of songs that might have been on that record. You know, I like the fact that Megaforce had bands like King's X and
yeah,
bands that were thinking outside of the box and actually having some success with unconventional music. And I met Johnny and Marcia, and they were just intense characters that were extremely passionate about what they did. And so it seemed like an odd fit, but I thought, let's give this a try. You know, I really respect their commitment to the music. They loved all sorts of music. And although for the most part, it was a pretty heavy label, musically speaking.
But he loved the Disco Biscuits.
Right. That's right. And would be passionate about things that you would never expect. But yeah, the key ingredient was how passionate he was about music in general and about his artists and about making his artist happen, you know.
Yeah.
Chuck Lavelle, you know, Chuck and I knew of each other at that time, but my first manager, whose name was Doc Fields, had spent most of his time in Atlanta and had moved to Nashville, and I was living in Nashville. And when I first started thinking that I wanted to shop for a record deal as a solo artist, I hooked up with Doc, and he was very quick to get a lot of interest generated from some major labels, et cetera. And then we started talking about producers, and he said, well, what about Chuck Lavelle? He was friends with Chuck and brought Chuck up as a possibility. And I thought, yeah, I think that would be a really good fit. It's a connection that makes sense. And that kind of forged a lifelong friendship between Chuck and myself, which I think was probably inevitable anyway. But at that point, we had not met or worked together. And then we just hit it all famously, you know.
I do kind of like that he has obviously, he's just such a part of the family. As you say, it's an obvious thing that like you two would have been in the same orbit eventually anyway, but it's just like, it's been cool, for example, seeing him in the mix of the shows that you've done with the brothers, you know, in recent times.
Yeah. I mean, Chuck's fantastic, and his legacy, looking back at all the amazing stuff he's done and played on and people he's played with, and he's just such a personality player. You know, he's one of those rare people that when he plays, people recognize who that is. You know, you hear a piano part and you go, well, that's either Chuck Lavelle or it's somebody trying to sound like Chuck Lavelle.
Yeah, 100%. You know, I ran a morning of interviews that he was doing one time with radio. And it was funny because they were on the phone. And as he was like doing the interviews You know, we would go in between radio stations. And so when we were between radio stations and I'm getting the next radio station on the line, like he'd just be sitting there like playing away on the piano. And it's like, it's got to be inspiring for you, like just somebody that is like so musical like that all the time.
Yeah. And I'm really fortunate to be surrounded by so many people that have that intense musicality that are just like, there's music in their heads all day long, you know, and we influence each other and learn from each other and inspire each other. And it's an amazing luxury. You know, I think of all the wonderful musicians in my orbit, it's just fantastic. And you couldn't want or expect more in life, you know?
Yeah. Well, here's where I'm going to leave it, Warren. And that just is, I am impressed that you always have the grind. Like you're just always bouncing back and forth between so many things. It is not just Warren Haynes Band and Government Mule. There's like obviously been like the Last Waltz tour. There's been like the symphonic stuff you did with, you know, Jerry Garcia's music, on and on and on. So it's really impressive seeing you maintain that. Like, so knowing that, like, what are we looking at the rest of the year? Anything else that you want folks to know about? Like, for example, is there going to be a Christmas jam this year? Like, you know, what's kind of on tap that, you know, should be mentioned in brief as we go out here?
Well, we'll be making a Christmas jam announcement soon, very soon. And it won't be this year, but on the horizon also is, since you brought up the symphony dates, there's a live album with the symphony coming out that is, I'm really, really proud of. And it's with Oteil Burbridge and Jeff Sipe and,
oh, wow,
John Medeski and Greg Osby, and Edwin McCain and Jasmine Muhammad are singing back up. And it was recorded in Asheville with the Asheville Symphony Orchestra. And it's been in the can since COVID, because we recorded it before COVID, and when COVID hit, I didn't want to release something that like this. That's a once in a lifetime thing. It's kind of a retrospective two disc set of, you know, it's got songs from my solo records, Government Mule songs, Allman Brothers songs, Grateful Dead songs. There's a band cover. It just represents 30 years of my life as interpreted by a fantastic band and the symphony orchestra. So that record's coming. It's in the pipeline. I probably shouldn't even mention it, but I can't wait for it to come out.
That's cool, man. Well, wrapping on a good note there for sure. Warren, thank you as always for the time. It's always good, and good luck as you continue to do it out there with the Mule and otherwise.
Thanks, man. Good to talk
to
you.
Likewise. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. One of the things I want to mention to you, man, is obviously it's super cool that when you guys played Red Rocks, you got to play Jerry's guitar. And I just wondered, like, you know, how did that come about? Like, is that the first time you played it? You've played that before, right?
No, that's the first time I played that one. And it's a friend of ours who we've known for maybe 25, 30 years somehow ended up with that guitar and mentioned bringing it out to Red Rocks, and it happened to be on Jerry's birthday, and so I told him to bring it out, and I played the thing at soundcheck, and it just had it just sounds like him. If you put only the middle pickup on, it wanted to be played a certain way. And I don't play a lot of Jerry's stuff. I mean, I've listened to him, you know, on and off over the years, but I never went fully down the rabbit hole. But immediately that guitar just wanted to be handled a certain way. It was pretty incredible. And it's, I've never played a guitar with a metal neck, and it weighed like 900 pounds compared to the SG. When I picked the SG up, I almost flung it. It was so light. It was quite a contrast, but it was really special playing that thing. I mean, it's, there some instruments, I mean, some players have such their own sound, so it's so their own thing that the instruments they choose, I think, are part of that. But some instruments just have a thing, man. I've picked up a few along the way that just have, they want to be played a certain way. They sound a way. They dictate kind of the way you play, which is really fun. I find that when every once in a while I buy an old vintage guitar and you immediately write a few songs with them, because there's just they sound a certain way and they're kind of begging for a certain thing. So, but that was certainly one of those special instruments where the next few days I was thinking about it. I was like, shit, I wish I had that for a while. I feel like there's some stuff to discover in that thing.
You know, it's cool because as long as you've been playing now, like, it's fun hearing you talk about like picking up a guitar, you know, when you buy a guitar somewhere and immediately writing a few songs with it, because that is a common thing. I think that happens to guys like you that are so into it, but like, it's kind of cool that you are still chasing that at that point, that you still get off when you have a moment like that, when you find a guitar like that, that, you know, that there's, because I think that guys like yourself believe, and I believe it too, man, that there are songs in guitars.
Yeah, man, I really do. I mean, and especially old acoustic guitars. I think there's something about the way the wood ages, and there's just certain harmonics that sound good on certain instruments where it's a certain chord is dead on one instrument. You pick it up and you play just a cowboy D chord, and it sounds like the most glorious thing you've ever heard. So it's really wild. I notice with open tunings, it's that way. There's certain guitars that just speak in certain places, and it makes things that maybe didn't seem obvious or vibrant, all of a sudden it's certain things seem really important, and then you write towards that. So yeah, I think there's something to it on a bass level, and then some instruments, who knows who owned it before you, like who knows what's, you know. And I think with, I mean, you're talking about wood. These are like living things, some of these instruments. And if you play it a certain way long enough, I think those notes and vibrations have to have some effect on it. So I think there's maybe something to that.
Yeah. Well, you know, switching gears, because we could talk about guitars for a long time. I think it's pretty special that you got to do the tribute to Mad Dogs and Englishmen. And it's hard to believe, man, it's been a decade now. I'm glad that this is coming out officially. Folks are going to get a chance to see the film again as well. But if we go back to the moment where it got to the point of rehearsals, like, what are kind of for you the moments that stick with you personally about the rehearsals and then the show itself?
I mean, that thing was pretty magical from the start. You know, the fact, I mean, originally we were supposed to do a show at Lock-In with Joe Cocker, and then he got sick and passed before the show came together. So they asked us to do a tribute to Joe, and as big of a fan as I am, I didn't really know him, and we had a few discussions about the show we were going to do. So I didn't feel comfortable doing a Joe tribute, but then the idea of the Mad Dogs thing came up, and we knew Leon, and you know, that's kind of one of the reasons we put this band together the way we did, was after watching that film, me and Sue, we were home. And so I reached out to Leon about it, thinking, because I had heard the stories that when that tour ended, everyone just kind of just went to their separate corners and recovered. And some of them never saw each other again after that. So I didn't know how he would react to it. But much to my surprise, he was like, yeah, let's do it. I'd be into doing that. And then as soon as Leon signed on, everyone that got wind of it, that was a part of it, were reaching out. Like, I was in the Mad Dog. It was like, well, bring it. So we got as many people together as we could. And, you know, we did 3 or 4 days of rehearsal down in our studio with just our band, because I didn't know who was still playing and what shape people were in. And the original, I just didn't know other than Leon. Our idea was, we're going to come in loaded for bear. At the very least, it's going to sound good with just the band. And then whatever is added is just going to be icing. And we rolled into that rehearsal, and it was one of the most incredible scenes I've ever been a part of, because there's a lot of people, I mean, these legends that hadn't seen each other since that tour, and the reverence for Leon, everyone there was calling him maestro. And it was, you know, Chris Staten, who I played in the Clapton band with, when he saw Leon, it was just like the most beautiful hugs and reunion. I have chills thinking about it. Like, it really, I felt honored. I think our whole band felt honored, and crew felt honored to be in the room to kind of witness everyone getting back together. And there was this real palpable sense that no one ever thought that would happen again. And there was a real, just a real gratitude that it was happening. And Rita Coolidge and Claudia Lanier and Dave Mason, and I mean, it was just legends. And people that I heard about growing up that, you know, they were just kind of always in the air, but I didn't know them. I never thought we'd be in a room for their musical high school reunion. So it was incredible. And then we played the first tune and that choir busted out and everybody came just like we did, loaded for bear. I think they were like, they kind of knew who we were, but we're not going to let these guys come in. Like it was awesome, man. Like no one rolled in there just kind of resting on their laurels. Like everyone came in like it was the Super Bowl, and the rehearsals just from the first song on was just, it was kind of magic, you know? And I knew we only had one shot of it. We had one show, you know, we had one day of rehearsal and then kind of a half day of rehearsal on site and, you know, a little dressing room. And then you hit the stage with 40 people. I don't know how many people it was. It was almost 30 people with the guests coming and going, and two or three of the guests couldn't make the rehearsal, so it was just on the fly. I think Chris Robinson and Warren and just kind of rolled in, and maybe I think Doyle was there for the thing, but so some of it was just completely on the fly. And rehearsals went well, but you get on stage in front of 10,000-20,000 people, you never know how it's going to go. And from the first note, everyone had this sense of, oh shit, this is really good. And then you're kind of just like, I hope if it ends half as good as it started, we'll be in good shape. And it just kind of kept getting better as it went. So there was this sense of, when is it going to go off the rails? And it just never did. So it was a special night, man. Everyone got off that stage, and it's not often we're hypercritical and super self-critical as a band. And it's not often you get off stage and it's just kind of a celebration. So that was a special show. I've been a part of a lot of different things over the years, and that one it holds a really unique place. And I feel like we were very lucky to be a part of it.
I love that there's that pearl that, like you said, like you and Susan had watched the film and that kind of gave you like the seed of the idea that like we could do something like this. What was it about the film that grabbed you back then?
You know, I mean, it's kind of this romantic notion of what the 60s and 70s should have been or could have been or what it wanted to be. When I look at the inside cover of the Brothers and Sisters, Allman Brothers record, and it's just the families and the crew. And I kind of grew up in and around that. And, but you know, kind of in some ways the aftermath of it, which, was sometimes beautiful and oftentimes not. And, I think when we watched that film, we kind of had that sense of, you know what, I think we could do this maybe with a little more wisdom. we've been at this a minute already. It's not like we're going into it blind. But we could kind of take that same spirit and maybe just not do all the drugs and all the, like, not everyone in the band sleep with each other and do every drug and just totally spin out. I think we could still have fun and go out there and do our thing. But yeah, we just had that sense of, I think we're still young enough energy to do this, but maybe a little bit wiser and maybe we could do it proper. But we didn't know how long it would last, you know, and we also figured if we were ever going to take on a big band, that was the time to do it, because you know, it doesn't make any sense financially or emotionally or with your time. Like it's so much to do something like that. I remember when we first brought it up to our manager and agents and everything, and they're like, what's wrong with you? What do you do? Why would you do that? You're like, because it sounds really fucking good and it's really fun. And
it's like the classic, like, it's the classic like manager conversation where it's like, if it was Spinal Tap or whatever, any sort of comedy movie, the manager reaction would be like, cool, so you're letting me know we're going to lose a lot of money for the next bunch of years.
Pretty much. Yeah. They're like, you know, there's easier ways to do this. So,
yeah.
But I mean, there's something to it from the very earliest days with our band. Like you roll into a small venue or a radio station or with 11, 12 members. It's like it's a small army. They know you mean business. They know you're not there just messing around. It's like you didn't roll out of bed to do that. Like you meant it. So there's just a sense of that that's kind of grown and carried, and now it's just kind of turned into its own monster. And I can't really imagine it any other way.
It really has. And I have to tell you, Derek, like when I first talked to you and Susan about this thing, when you guys first took the band on the road, it really was kind of like almost like the proof of concept tour, the kind of like, we might never do this again. And man, I saw the tour, and I've seen tours like this where it's like, it's so cool, this is never going to happen again. So the fact that you have like pulled it off, like, is so cool. Like, what's the moment where you guys felt like it was going to work and last? Like, how far into it were you guys before you felt that?
I mean, there was a sense right out of the gate that there was something unique and special going on. I mean, and in the very early days, it was Kofi and O'Teal and the Burbridge brothers. And there was a sense of something really special about that. And then I think early in that first record, we were making Revelator with Jim Scott, the producer, and just writing with all the different writers. And then Mike Madison just rolled in with just a few songs that immediately you're like, well, this is, we're going to be playing these for the rest of our lives. You can just feel it, you know? And every once in a while you write a tune as a band and it just solidifies the thing more and more. Like, we just finished making a record. We tracked like 17 tunes and the record will be some of those. And we'll do a little, probably an EP or something. But again, there was a handful of songs where you're just like, this is, you know, this is what separates a project from a band. You know, I think it's the songs and the repertoire. And I think pretty early in this band, there were a handful of songs like that. And then they don't come every time around, you know. There's songs that are fun to play and ideas that are cool that you flesh out and they turn into tunes and you feel good about them for a while, but there's some that, you know, right out of the gate that these are different and these are going to go the distance. So, you know, once you get about a half dozen of those, I feel like you're kind of, you don't have to be, but you can be in for the long haul if you want to be, because that's what separates. I mean, when we go back and do the Almonds thing, occasionally it just hits you that, man, this catalog is really incredible. I mean, you don't play the songs for 5 years or so and you pick them up and you immediately just, you fall right back into that place and you love it and you know everything about it. And it's, those are special places to be. So when that started happening with us, that's when I realized it was different than other projects I had been a part of.
Yeah. And I mean, you mentioned the Almonds, like, you know, that's what I kind of love about what you guys are doing with this band is that, like, you know, if you do pull out like an Almonds song, like, you know, you kind of go all over the place with the songs that you guys play, but like, you're more likely to play, like, one of the songs I saw recently was like, you guys did like Stand Back. Like, that is not like a pedestrian pick. And, you know, we can go across the board with, like, you know, you guys have done Dylan songs that are not like the expected Dylan song if somebody pulls out a cover. And it's like, it really does feel like they're, what I like about what you guys do is there's like a educational element to it that you guys are keeping this music out there, which is great.
You know, and a lot of times those tunes that we pick are ones that, it's funny you say educational, because it's the ones that when you hear from somebody's catalog, you're like, oh, well, that's interesting. I never thought of that. Like, it's an education for us, like a different song form or it's a different approach, because we all know the low hanging fruit with different artists. Those songs are already in our heads and we kind of already know those song forms and we know those changes and those moves. So when we hear a song that's maybe a little different, a different groove, a different pocket, a different time signature, those are often fun to explore, because I notice when we play tunes, sometimes 2, 3, 4 years later, you're writing a tune and you'll kind of gravitate to these moves and you're like, oh, I know where I got that from, because that's what everyone does. You're always, and so it's good to kind of dig into the other tunes. I remember we did a track for Malia Clapton has this charity she does for you know, recovery, alcohol and recovery patients. And Doyle Bramhall came down to our studio and we did a George Harrison tune called Be Here Now. And it's just one I had never heard. And I was just like, this is incredible. Like, it just opened a whole door. So I find learning people's material and learning people's songs and the way they write tunes is an important part of learning how to do it yourself. We were this Music Cares speech that Bob Dylan did years ago when he got the award or whatever, and he stood up there and it was super defiant and over the top and crazy. We happened to be in the room for it, but some of the stuff he said made a lot of sense. He's like, people ask how you write Highway 61, And he said, you know, you grew up playing Key to the Highway and you sing those songs 1,000 times like I did, you would have written Highway 61 too. And you're like, there is a direct line between the music that you grow up playing and the songs that you hammer over and over again, and then the stuff that you write. Dylan came at a time where there was just a collision of all this stuff, but that dude was, he was learning every folk tune that he could possibly learn. And that's where that vocabulary came from. So it's all part of the education.
Yeah. I think what it is also that I should have said in that initial thing is like, you all are music fans and that comes clear, you know, and I think because you guys are that way, like there's just a more thought out approach to it. And you know what, man, like if somebody has not been inspired to find their way into Dylan from hearing the classics, if they hear something like, I don't know, man, like Down in the Flood, like if they hear Down in the Flood, they're like, shit, I got to check out Bob Dylan. And that's ridiculous to say here in 2025, but we know that like younger generations, like there are still people finding their way into Bob Dylan for the first time. And maybe it's through you. Maybe you're the gateway. And that's awesome.
It's a wild thing, man. I'm just realizing now, I was the youngest musician in the room for so long that it takes a while for your brain to realize that you're far from that anymore. And I met some musicians not long ago who didn't know who the Beatles were, and I thought they were kidding, but they weren't kidding. You know, it's just like, wow, it's a different world now. It's a totally different world. We're in a different place. So, yeah, I mean, it doesn't seem like that should be likely, but sometimes we are the entry point to a Bob Dylan or some of this music. So it's fun to be a part of that lineage, but yeah, it's a different day. That's for sure.
Here's the final thing, cause I know we're up against it. But like you have, as you say, a new record done. Is that next year? When is that? Because I know you guys have been doing some of the songs live.
Yeah, I think it'll be early next year. You know, we have this Mad Dog thing coming out, and then, we finished mixing. We're still mastering the record and all of that stuff. But I think it'll be early next year that we finally release it.
Well, Derek, thank you always for the time, man. I'll let you run on, but always a pleasure talking tunes with you, man. I'll see you.
Yep, bye-bye. Great to chat. See you, man.
There's our first two interviews with Warren Haynes and then just now Derek Trucks, two of the nicest guys you'll ever meet in this music business. It is Matt Wardlaw. As promised, we are going to round out today's podcast with a bonus interview of sorts. As I mentioned in the intro, I talked to Derek and Susan back in 2022, and at that time, we were discussing the series of 4 albums that they had just put out called I Am the Moon. And you know what? The audio breaks up, but I loved hearing Susan mention that they had been watching a lot of episodes of The Mandalorian, and that gave them the idea to release the 4 parts of I Am the Moon in an episodic way. And I'm still not 100% sure that she was serious, but I just like knowing that maybe Star Wars was a part of their process with those albums. We also talked about some other things, including a few stray comments on the Mad Dogs tribute and their experience paying a separate tribute at the Lock-In Festival to Layla and other assorted love songs by Derek and the Dominoes. There is a lot here that I think you all will dig, and if you have never heard Derek and Susan hanging out like this, this conversation will give you a good window into the vibe that they have, and so I thought it was also worth sharing in that regard. There are some audio imperfections in the way it was recorded at the time, as I mentioned in the intro, but it won't take away from your ability to enjoy this interview. And if you want more information on some of the things that they mention, you can find that at their website, TedeschiTrucksBand.com.
First of all, I have to tell you both like how excited I was when I saw the news about this album. Like, it's just so cool to not even album, the 4 albums, you know? So I guess that's kind of where I'd like to start, is that I love Mike's notes for this project. The concept is so exciting, yet I can imagine that there could have been moments where you're going, is this a crazy idea? Is it pompous? You know, if we want to look at this like a concept record, concept albums are a delicate line to walk. So I really wondered, like, what do you two kind of recall about the range of thoughts that were kind of flying around within the group and yourselves personally?
I mean, I kind of feel like it had already happened before we tried to figure out what had happened. So, you know, we definitely didn't go into it thinking, hey, let's make 4 records and let's do this grand thing. We kind of went in with the seed of the idea that Mike had of just taking that old poem and us all chewing on it while we were stuck at home and just thinking about it from a different perspective, thinking about Layla's perspective. And it was just kind of a it was a healthy thought exercise just to keep the band kind of in the same headspace when we couldn't be together. And then once we did get together, I think it was just so much pent up energy from being stuck at home and not playing and not digging, that there was just this real joy of like writing and hanging and creating. And we just did a lot of it. And then we got, I don't know, I think we got about 15 or 20 tunes in where we realized we have something on our hands here. We're not sure what it is. And then it became, well, how do we want to do this? And there was a thought of, you know, there's the traditional thought, well, let's just pick 10, 11 songs and release it. And then we have this other material for down the road. And we're like, that just doesn't feel right. Like, I don't know what it would be. And then there was this idea, well, let's just release it all at once. And then we would listen to it all together upstairs. And it just was too much for one city. Like, I felt like it lost its power when it was all at once. And then I just don't think anyone has that kind of attention span anymore. And like, it felt like a waste to do it that way. And then, you know, we had been doing the weekly episodes, the fireside sessions, where every Thursday there would either be a live concert of the band from years past, or we would record one in the studio. And it kind of became this gathering place during the lockdown for our fans to meet up. And so we had that idea. Sue was kicking around.
We were watching a lot of DeLorean.
Watching different weekly shows with our kids. And like, let's release this like episodes where people look forward to the next installment. And there's, because there's a through narrative to all the material. There was a natural through line because we were all kind of delving back to the same source material, even when we were separated. And so when we started sequencing the record, there was just this real beautiful narrative, even like from the first record with Crescent, you can just feel all the characters being introduced, Sue and Gabe singing in the first tune, and then and then the horn section is like it's like the Muppets or the cartoon characters in the background. And it just, you kept feeling this story kind of unfold. And that's kind of when the light bulb went off, four parts. And, you know, thinking about just how badass the back cover of A Love Supreme looks when you see it broken up into pieces like that. And so those are all things that were kind of kicking around in our head. And just, and Mike made Mike wanted to make sure from the beginning, especially when we talked about doing images with it in the film, or we were thinking about animating it or something, that we didn't try to make a rock opera. Like, it wasn't, we weren't trying to stick to a story directly, but it was inspired by, and there was a through line. And it very much mirrored what was kind of going on in the world. Like, everyone's kind of isolated, and we all knew people that were kind of spinning out into fucking madness. You were just kind of checking in on people, like, are you okay? And, you know, there was a lot of longing for things you couldn't have, or things you couldn't do, or people you couldn't have. And so I don't know, it was a weird parallel between the life the whole world was leading in the first half of 2020 and kind of the isolation in the story.
I want to highlight in the midst of that whole answer that I'm happy that somewhere in all this, the Muppets were there spiritually. I like that.
Our band is full of Muppets.
You know, I mean, some bands, and you'd be aware of this, but some bands I've spoken with really struggled working on songs individually during the pandemic. And it seems like you all were really able to flesh these songs out in interesting ways, which wouldn't have necessarily happened if you weren't passing them around kind of in that way.
That's true.
Yeah. I mean, we were lucky. We had our studio and our home with enough extra bedrooms and couches. And once we could get tested and families were good with letting their significant others leave the nest, everyone came and lived with us. So
cool.
Everyone was freaking around these ideas separately in the beginning. But once we got together, there was just a lot of, I mean, it kind of felt like the early days of being in the band where you're kind of living together and, you know, there's no going out to eat. So you're cooking together and you're just kind of in it together. So we did that at our house and up at our farm in Georgia. It was a lot of FaceTime with everybody and just, I don't know, reconnect.
But the four of us, definitely.
Yeah.
Because we couldn't have the whole band together because some of our horn players live far away, like Texas and California.
It was all the people that were driving distance.
Yeah, so Blue Rip was in driving distance we could do stuff with.
Yeah.
Including the fireside sessions that we did during the lockdown. So it wasn't like we were just making the actual four records. We actually made a bunch of live performances as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, so we had a lot of things going on.
It was good
this way. It was not a time off.
No.
But you know, it was good to be busy because it ended up being 20 months, 19 months.
Those 18, yeah.
Without a paid gig. So we needed to do something to keep our heads from spinning out of like, what are we going to do? It's a big band and organization, and we, you know, trying to hold it together. It was, if we didn't have something to work on, we probably would have really spun out. You can always do so much yard work.
Yeah.
So, like, we need to be busy. So it was pretty incredible, though, I got to say. And it really, I think it saved the band in a lot of ways. Because I think after losing Kofi and after going through the last handful of years that we went through leading up to this, I think we needed a reset.
Yeah.
JJ left the band in February.
No, so we were kind of reeling, you know, just those losses and just trying to reevaluate all we wanted to do. Because we've been on the road nonstop for 30 years, all of us. Well, you know. Yeah. And
there's that.
And this forced stop was kind of I think necessary, and it made us realize how much we enjoy making records and writing music together and having that
not touring.
Yeah, because I mean, there really is something too when you're in the studio writing, and there's no gigs on the horizon. It's a totally different feeling than being in the studio writing when in 8 days you have to be up in New York for an 8-night run at the Beacon.
Yeah.
And you got 120 songs, and it's hard to not have that just breathing down your neck or thinking about, all right, this is cool, the creativity part, but we need to pivot. You get to work. So it was really, I didn't realize how nice it was to have that freedom of thought and space that we had during this time.
And you mentioned the Fireside Sessions. I was glad you did that. Were there any songs that like kind of inspirationally came from doing that in the midst of all this, doing those? Because I watched some of them.
Yeah, because some of them we had written for the records, but we actually put them on there, like La-Di-Da.
La-Di-Da, Here, My Dear.
And Here, My Dear. Yeah. I think we could, too.
I can feel your smilings on there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We could even release
them. There's a few songs on there that, because I don't even think we realized we were making a record yet. We had just started writing music. We had this concept. But we weren't protective of the new material. We were just playing it because we'd written it 2 days before. We're like, oh, this will be fun.
Yeah.
When we started making a record, I realized, you know, we need to hold this stuff back. So when the albums come out, it feels nice and fresh and no one knows the material. So but yeah, a few of those did sneak into the Fireside stuff.
How did you mentioned the film part of it. Like, how did the film component come into all this?
Well, once we decided that we were going to release these as four records and that we wanted them to be proper vinyl length, you know, sides, the idea of, I mean, I've been kicking around for a while. It's always been frustrating the last decade or so when you release a record and you work on it for the better part of a year and then 2 months before the album comes out, they give away the first two tracks for free digitally. And then there's two singles and there's some other track that comes out. And so five of the tunes of the 11 people have already heard, but in no particular order, the record comes out and you're like, okay, well, there's five other songs you haven't heard. It doesn't really, like, you spend all this time thinking about the sequence and the way you want something to be heard. And then it just doesn't happen. So I've been thinking about ways to kind of combat that, and one of them was the Fireside stuff, the episodes. I was like, what if we save the material and then we release them, the everyone gets to hear it for free the first time, or we just air it, and like maybe we just put a fire on the screen, like a fireplace fire, logs in the fire, and or some images of the band, or maybe we animate it. And then we're like, well, why don't we have this time. Mike knew Alex Lambert, a great filmmaker. It's like, why don't we just go? Why don't we actually go for it? And we'll film and it'll be a mix of all this stuff. But it really, the original idea was a way to have people communally hear the record for the first time in one sitting.
Yeah.
No leaked music before it happens. And so when the first one came out, we were actually still home. And, you know, my parents came over, my sister and her husband, and our kids are there. And it was really nice sitting down and watching the thing together, and they hadn't heard the material or seen it. And it was a good feeling sitting down and knowing that a lot of our fans around the country, around the world are listening to it, hearing the stuff for the first time. And minutes leading up to it, Sue is super nervous. So there's today now, like, there's nothing we can do. But you just don't know how it's going to land. You can feel that something's incredible, and then it comes out, and people are like, eh. you never know. And so it was a good feeling when the next day my mom came over and she was just really moved by it. Like, it's nice to have those moments. It's nice to see that stuff in real time.
Isn't it a good feeling, Susan, that you get nervous? Like, it's like, obviously you still give a shit, but it's like, that's kind of proof that you give a shit. Like, when you have something that, like, that's about to happen, it's like, I'm really nervous about this. Like you said, Derek, we can't do anything about it now, but it's like, this is going out in the world. Like, you both collectively and individually have made a pile of records, piles of records, and yet it's like you still have that feeling like you're putting out your first record. That's really cool.
Yeah, we still get nervous. Well, I don't know about him, but I do. I don't know.
No, I mean, you kind of have a little bit of that every night. I mean, we tour all the time, and we were talking the other night because playing this new material has felt really different than in the past, where a lot of times you play new stuff and people just don't necessarily respond to it a certain way. And this felt different. The crowds have been there with us from the jump, but still, every night we write a set list and like, ooh, I don't. If we put this here, people are gonna. If you and you just don't know, and then you play it, and if people are with you, you're like, I forget that people are actually coming to see us. Like, we've been on the road so long, and other people's bands are opening for bands where you just felt like you have to. It's a battle every night to win over the audience, and that at some point you do, and then you can relax and play. And I don't think we've fully shifted and realizing that. Like, oh, they're not leaving. Like, we can improvise and stretch out. They're not going anywhere. This is great. It's got it. But we still have that mentality. Like, we're, you know, you're still kind of punching up at all times. But I think that's good.
What are some of the songs that, for one reason or another, you were, you know, nervous to put in the set? Like, whether it's, you know, are we ready to pull this off yet? Not just crowd response, but like, were there songs from these records that like you were, you know, nervous about just like, you know, bringing into the set for those kind of reasons?
I mean, at first, yeah, just learning them and making sure I could play and sing them at the same time.
Yeah.
You know, in heels and not mess them up. And
your heels of the wah-wah pedal.
Yeah. Wah-wah pedal. Well, also I had two knee surgeries this year.
Oh my God. Oh no.
Been a busy year.
On tour, I got hurt in January, and we didn't get home from tour until the last day of February. And on March 1st, I had my first knee surgery, which was kind of nuts. So that was crazy. And then got that one fixed and then hurt the other one. And then literally had surgery a few days after I hurt it just so I could go back on tour so I could stand.
Wow.
Because I did want to go on tour and not be able to stand up. So that's been kind of, you know, a lot of stuff going on, as well as all of the records, as well as kids moving out and going to college, as well as everybody in the band has families. And there's this, you know, there's always 1,000 things that happen that people were, you know, they're not aware of. And so, you know, you get it nervous because you just wanted to do the best you can, but you know, you just don't want to mess up. You know, you want it to be good and you want everyone to like it, but at the same time, you want to like it.
Yeah,
it's like you want to make sure you like it. And
I think there were a few specific songs, like I think Circles Around the Sun or something, that felt like maybe a little different for us in the studio. It was kind of a throw it against the wall creation. You're like, how is this going to translate live? Or are the subtle background and horn parts, are those going to be obvious enough when we're playing live to carry these sections? Or some of the subtle stuff is kind of harder to pull off live, but it's really great. It's been really great.
Yeah.
And
we've played the first record all the way through a bunch of times. The second record, we've been adding some of the songs, but haven't played the whole thing in its entirety straight.
And I just realized the third one comes out tonight. So we can add. So we should probably learn a song today. Yeah.
Could be good. Could be a good move. Yeah.
We got work to do.
Yeah.
Maybe yes. Stuff. Yes, we will. We should play tonight. Or Take Me As I Am, one of those two. Or whatever she learns, we'll play. She decides.
I'm good at remembering my own songs.
I'm glad you mentioned it that way, because, like, I think it shows you the passage of time, because, like, you know, with the way you staged the four of these albums for release, it's like, it seems like every Friday I turn around, it's like, oh, the second one's out. And then it's like, as you just said, it's like, I realize, like, oh, the third one's coming out. Like, you know, what seemed like it was going to be a lot to wait for as a fan, it's like they've actually, people just sometimes don't realize that time rolls in general, but a summer flies by. So as the summer is flying, it's like they're kind of dropping in at each point. It's kind of cool the way they just kind of arrive like that.
Yeah, it's been flying for us. I mean, we've been out on tour with Los Lobos for a little over a month now, right around a month. And yeah, there's been two records to come out since we started rehearsing for this tour. And then the third one's about to hit. And yeah, we have a lot of material we need to learn. it's been fun, though.
I was going to ask, like, when did you first meet the Los Lobos guys? Because they're so cool. Like, such an amazing band.
I mean, we off and on. I mean, I think they opened for the Allman Brothers years and years ago.
Yeah.
Remember with my solo band, we had a day off in Rochester, and they were playing, like, in this park down the street. Me and Mike Madison walked around.
Remember that.
And then they were playing Don't Keep Me Wondering, the Allman Brothers tune, and I was just like, hell yeah.
And they were kind of tipsy.
They're not afraid to throw down, that's for sure. And then when we toured with them maybe 5-6 years ago, I think 2016, they came out. I think by the fourth or fifth show, there was a day off, and everyone just started kind of barbecuing in the parking lot.
Nice.
Named this incredible hang, and then we've been thick as thieves since then, and it's just gotten better and better. And when we had to cancel those two, or postpone the two Wheels of Souls tours from 19 and 20, or 20 and 21, the bands that were going to do it could no longer do it, and immediately we thought, our original idea was never to repeat an act on the Wheels of Soul, but when no one had toured, we were like, who would we like to be on the road with? And everyone to a person was like, Los Lobos. Like, that's who I want to party with if this is the last tour that ever happens. And so it's been a blast, man. They are incredible people. And I mean, they've been together 50 years, and you go on their tour bus, and like the four or five original members are just sitting up front together, just talking shit. It's a beautiful, beautiful hang. You know, I mean, I've been around legacy bands and bands that have been around for decades, and they don't all hang like that.
No,
it's a special energy and chemistry that they have, and it's you can hear it on stage. They are treasures.
And I first got to know David and Caesar. I was doing the Experience Hendrix tour.
Oh, cool! So yeah,
we were with them back in like 2009, and we were all on the tour bus together. So it was fun.
Yeah,
I got to hang out with those guys, and we would play with like Hubert Sumlin and Billy Cox and those guys. It was amazing. It was kind of a dream, honestly. And they were really sweet. And David and Caesar, we would hang out.
One of the first times David Hidalgo and Louie from Los Lobos hung was at a Whiskey A Go-Go Allman Brothers show in 1969. And he had Polaroids of Dwayne and Barry and my uncle, which they showed me. I think that's incredible. So our history weirdly goes back a long way without, you know, directly.
And they were really close with the Grateful Dead too, which we have a similar thread there too, which is pretty wild.
Yeah, they did that great version of Bertha at one point on, I think, the Grateful Dead dedicated tribute record. That was just like, that was one of the early things that like sold me in on like, all right, this band is they're incredible. So that's cool. The Layla album, I mean, it's an album you both knew, and it's got some, you know, spiritual ties to these albums that you're putting out now. I wondered, like, you know, you played that album in full at Lockin. Like, what did you find, you know, once you dug deep into the songs to play them as a band? And what do you think you took away from that experience? Because if we put how they contributed to the albums that we're talking about today to the side, I just wondered what else you all took from it. What sort of new appreciation you gained and that kind of thing?
I mean, I love the songwriting on that record and kind of the, I don't know, just the simple little moves and, whenever you take the time to learn music like that, it always informs your playing. I mean, because you learn little quirky chord changes or little guitar patterns that you would have never thought of. And then it's kind of forever in your vocabulary, you know?
Yeah.
And sometimes it'll kind of sneak out when you're doing other things. Or you just know that sometimes you're writing songs and you're hearing where you think the changes should go or there's a move. And if you didn't know this chord change from another tune, you might not know to maybe sneak it in here. Or it's always fun, especially, I mean, I think Clapton being around the Beatles so much then, that stuff had to influence his songwriting. So I almost feel like George Harrison-esque writing and some of those changes. I looked away in some of those tunes that I never had learned fully, even though I toured with him. We didn't play all of those songs.
I Am Yours.
I Am Yours.
Played that together. It was gorgeous. Yeah,
that was an amazing one.
Derek made me cry every night. He played live.
Yeah.
He plays Hello on that. It was so pretty.
That's a great tune. That was actually the tune I was looking up when we were going to do the rehearsals with Trey for that Layla record. I was trying to remember. It's like, I think this thing's inspired by a Sufi poem. And I think I Am Yours might be a Sufi poem. And I went to look up the lyrics and I saw the release date was the day Sue was born.
Wow.
I was like, there's no way that's true. I got to find another source. And sure enough, November 9th, 1870, that she was born was the day Layla came out. It's just kind of wild.
That's so cool. And I mean, the other thing, like doing the Mad Dogs and Englishmen project, that was a whole different thing. And obviously everybody's sad that Joe couldn't be a part of it. But that also just seems like it must've been such a powerful and rewarding experience. I loved that you guys got to do a film about the whole thing. It was really cool to see that.
That was a magical few days.
It was special. I mean, Leon's one of those people too. He's just for us, he was a living legend in the moment that was willing to come out and do this.
Yeah.
And then once he was in, everybody came out of the woodwork.
Yeah.
Right?
You know, that was a special thing. I don't know if you got to see the film, but the, just the reverence of the other musicians towards Leon and
yes,
kind of the family reunion that no one ever thought would happen. And it happened at rehearsal and it happened on stage. And it really went so much better than we ever imagined it could have. And, in spirit and music. So it was, that thing and doing that, Layla thing, I think were hugely important for this band. I mean, after we did the lock-in thing with Leon and the Mad Dogs, it kind of gave the band a different confidence going forward. That, you know what, not that a torch was passed, but it kind of was. I mean, everybody there was so happy with the way it felt.
Yeah.
And they were happy that there was a band kind of carrying on some of that legacy and in the way they went about it. And but there was also this sense of, oh yeah, but this is actually healthy.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, this has a chance. But it gave us a little swagger going forward as a band that, you know what, this is kind of a space that we can roll in. And then the Layla thing too. I mean, when you can pull off something like that as a one-off, and I mean, everyone just knocked it out of the park. Like from the first note to the end, it was kind of extraordinary. So those things gives you a little extra juice going forward, I think.
And both of those bands were 1970, and then Allman Brothers in 1970.
There's a lot going on.
And the Grateful Dead. Like you think about all four of those bands in that moment, they actually do really encompass a lot of our influences. And of course, Derek and I are both influenced by blues and jazz and gospel and things like that too, and folk music. But I would say those four bands is a big cornerstone of our stuff for sure.
I don't want to bypass what you said, Susan, about being around on Experience Hendrix, being around folks like Hubert Sumlin. That had to be, you know, a pretty important moment, like as a musician. Like it's an important thing to be around people like that.
It is. And honestly, Derek and I have both been incredibly blessed throughout our careers to be able to not only witness these people in the flesh, like just to even be a fan, but to get to play with them.
Yeah.
Travel with them or whatever, you know. I got to do how many tours with B.B. King? But oh my God.
Yeah.
I got to tour with John Lee Hooker and I got to record with Little Milton and, you know, Pine Top Perkins. Derek and I both got to play with Santana and, you know, Clapton, and it's like a dream.
We're in Chicago now, and whenever we play the Chicago Theater, I immediately remember when Pine Top, he came to sit in with the Allman Brothers, and me and Susan were sitting in one of the green rooms just before the set, hours before the set, and there was an upright piano, and Pine Top walks in, he's maybe 92 at the time.
Wow.
He sits down at the piano. He knew we were there. He didn't really say it. He just sat down and he started playing and singing for about 20 minutes. And I was just sitting on the couch just soon going. It's like, it's just in Chicago, a lot of places. So we've had some memorable hangs, you know, just.
Yeah, you play in like blues before sunrise or like all these different songs.
And but yeah, that stuff changes your DNA, you know, getting to. Yeah. People have a glass of wine with B.B. King after a show that stuff changes you.
So, you know, we've mentioned Eric a couple times, you know, not knowing what sort of lines of communication with Eric you have at this point, have you had a chance to share this I Am the Moon project with him in any form?
I haven't yet. We're going to be overseas in the fall, though. We'll probably cool. see him. So I'll drop some records on him.
Nice. Yeah, that's awesome. And just before we move off of those two different, the Layla and the Mad Dogs project, like, what's another album that you would like to tackle similarly with this band?
You know, those came about really naturally, and it was nothing we had planned on doing until the opportunity came up. I don't know if we'll ever do anything like that again. I mean,
you never know,
but you know, yeah, you never know. You never know.
'Cause it could be.
But when we got the call to do a show, because we had played a few Mad Dogs tunes, we got the call to do the show with Joe. We're like, all right, that makes sense.
Yeah.
And then when he passed, before we could do the show, they asked us to do a tribute. And I told him, I was like, you know, I'd love to, but I never really got to play with him. I talked to him, but like, I don't feel like I'm the one to do it. It doesn't feel right. I was like, now if Leon was a part of it, that would make sense. And thinking that there would be no way in hell that he would agree to do it. So when he said, I'll do it. I was like, well, you know, you were the band leader last time. He's like, I'm not doing that again. That's on you, Trucks. It's like, I'm here for support though. I was like, all right. But then it felt right. So that one just kind of came about, and the Layla thing with Trey, you know, they asked me to sit in with his band one night and then him with us. That was going to be the headlining of Lock In that year, was kind of that collaboration. And, you know, he had songs of ours he wanted to play. And then I mentioned a few Domino's tunes, and I could tell he lit up at that. And then I got off the phone with him and was talking to a friend at Red Rocks, and Julie Mendelson is her name. And she was like, you should just do the whole fucking album. And I was like, that's exactly what we should do. So I immediately called him back, and he was immediately into it. So I don't know. Things like that kind of happen spur of the moment.
Well, final bit here, and that just is, for something which might have once been perceived as, you know, being Derek and Susan's band, one thing that I think is really cool about these albums is how much the songwriting and vocals on these songs, whether it's, you know, Mike, of course, Gabe Dixon, etc., it really illustrates how much this is a united group and how important each individual person is to the whole process, what comes out. And what's really beautiful here is when faced with something like a pandemic, you all got a chance to really learn what is possible when you're working together, no matter the circumstances. And when I first talked to you two a few years ago, it's like you were just, you know, talking about what a difficult thing it was financially to take this group out on the road and make it work because of the size of the group. And it's like this pandemic, you know, was kind of the ultimate test for you guys as a unit. And I think this is a really beautiful picture of how you all emerged from that.
Awesome, man. I think that's what I'm proudest of with this record too, is when we finally got to watch all four films. I think we were planning on watching one a night, but we sat down, we poured a few drinks, we watched the first two, we're like, let's go make another drink and then watch the next two. And we finished the four. The thing that felt great to me was how much I could feel everybody in the band. I could feel all the personalities in the band and all the characters in the band, and listening to the record, I could feel Elizabeth and Kebby, and just everybody poked out in different ways. But just the way you feel all the Muppets. It's fun, and that includes us, you know. But I love that about the films too, is I really do think you get to experience the band the way we do on the tour bus. I feel like you get to know them a little bit better, which is fun.
All right, well, let me return the Muppets to their normal world. But thank you both. This was a lot of fun. Enjoyed talking with you as always.
We've reached the end of another episode of the UCR Podcast. It is Matt Wardlaw. We appreciate you listening. If you enjoy what you're hearing, please rate and review wherever you are listening, and hit subscribe so that you'll receive future episodes of the podcast from Ultimate Classic Rock.